Yeah, so I'm going to give what I understand is going to be the first of a few
more theory-based talks on how to generate non-Gaussian energies from inflationary models, rather than how to observe them. So this is based on some work I've been doing with Jim Klein at Laval University, McGill University. And so this is work in progress right now. In fact, the results that I'm going to show you at the very end have only been a product of the last 2 weeks. So this is very new. So all right, I'll give you a bit of a motivation. Why do we look for non-Gaussianities in this roulette inflation model or these scalar inflation models? So you probably know that recent literature has told us that non-Gaussian perturbations can arise from multiple field inflation models where you have large curvatures in field space. So you have some inflaton field that's described by two fields. And if you have a large bend in field space during inflation, you're likely to get some nonlinear effects. So this was illustrated in some papers by Rigopoulos, Schellard, and Bent. And they published a series of papers that I'm going to base my method on. Venizzi and Wands, Bernardo and Cousin. So this is an effect that's been seen by quite a few contexts. So large FNL, according to the literature, seems to be correlated with this perturbance of entropy modes, so modes that are perturbations that are transverse to the field direction and the rolling of the inflaton in field space. So this appears to be the case in the roulette model and maybe in some other Kähler inflation models. The question could be addressed later on. So this means that it's natural to look for non-Gaussianities. Well, this is a motivation in these highly curved trajectories in this roulette inflation model. I'll tell you a bit more what the roulette inflation model is in a second. And so you do get sizable FNL, I'm going to tell you right away, in this model with a few issues that I'll discuss later. So here's a bit of an outline of my talk. So I'm going to tell you about, first, the roulette model. What is it? Second, what the separate universe approach is. This is the Rigopoulos, Schellard, Bent, Tent approach. Then I'll give you a bit of an example on so how this works for kind of a general basic model of inflation. And then look at non-Gaussianities in the roulette model. So, all right, what is this roulette inflation model? So this is a paper by Bon, Kaufman, Patushkin, and Vodorovange that came out originally in 2000. It was on the archive in 2006. So it's a two-field inflation model. It's based on a type 2B string theory compactification. So it has two interesting points. One is that you have a non-canonical kinetic term. So you can't get a canonical kinetic term for both of the fields at once. And the second interesting point is that it has some interesting interactions in the potential. Both of these we think can probably give us some nonlinear effects in perturbations. So you can obtain some reasonable periods of inflation with some highly curved trajectories in the inflaton field space. So to give you a quick overview of the model, like I said, it's a type 2B string theory compactification. It uses the large volume stabilization that, if you haven't heard of this, it's fine. You can read about it in this paper by Clément Quevedo and Sudolitz in 2005. So the basic idea is that you have this, so you compactify your extra dimensions on a Calabi-Yau manifold, and there's a solution where this manifold is stable for very large volume. So the volume much, much greater than one. I'm using units where I'm applying is equal to L string to one. So you can write an effective n equals one action for the scalar terms. So these are the scalar fields that I'm going to be interested in. These are the Kähler moduli and the complex structure moduli that I'll tell you a bit more about later. And so this potential can be written in this form. This is a super potential from super gravity. And this thing is the Kähler metric, which is going to be important later on. So these T's are actually the same thing as, these phis. These are the Kähler moduli. So this is that potential. The important point is you can write the volume in this For certain classical IBL manifolds, you can write a volume in this way. So this is tau is a four cycle, the volume of a four cycle. So you express the volume of your Calabi-Yau in terms of the sum of, so you have one very, very large modulus that governs the overall volume. And you have a bunch of these little moduli, which you can think of as holes in the manifold. So you assume that this is very large, these are very small. So if you vary one of these, it's not going to change the overall volume, but it's still going to give you some interesting dynamics. It's going to give you some energy that can drive inflation. Now that superpotential, this thing I told you about earlier, can be written in this way in terms of these Kähler moduli. So this is what the Kähler modulus looks like. So you have this volume modulus, which is the volume, you can see the volume of the four cycles, and you have this axionic component, which comes from among four forms. But the important point is that you have this exponential behavior. So you have one direction that's going to be. So I'm going to use one of these tau fields, I'll tell you right away, and one of these theta fields to drive my inflation. So the real part is going to give me an exponentially flat region. And the imaginary part is going to give me some kind of sinusoidal behavior. So you can see where this roulette name is coming from. Just as a bit of an illustration for, so this is the picture you should have in mind. So you have this funny big manifold thingy.
Right, so you should have this e to the a t, and so t is complex, so you have this I theta, so you have an e to the I theta.
But your potential should be real, shouldn't it?
It is, but so you're going to get linear combinations of these values that's going to give you either exponentials or sines, cosines.
So how many fields are there now?
All right, so there are H11 fields, total fields. And this depends on the Calabi-Yau. It's not really important. We're going to say there are a lot. We're going to stabilize them all except for two. So it doesn't matter how many of these fields are. I should tell you also that these lambda, A, C, these are all parameters from the string theory. And we just take them to be parameters that we can vary and kind of mess around with to see what kind of behavior we get in terms of inflation. So I was just going to say that's exactly what I was going to say. So you make this assumption there's a hierarchy of mass between all these fields. And you just look at, so you assume that the universe is in some kind of excited state, and it relaxes in some particular order. And so the last two fields to relax, if you assume that they have about, if it's one of these tau fields and one of these theta fields of roughly the same mass, these are going to be what give us some observable inflation.
So you have this large volume that's kind of, everything's stabilized except for one of the four cycles, which finally at the very end of some bizarre period of inflation gives us what's the observable inflation. Right, so if you actually, so you stabilize all those fields except for
looks like this. So
it's this kind of. So the only important stuff to note here is you have this exponential in tau, and this cos theta term. So in this tau direction, it's exponentially flat. So you're going to start out, say, with some initial conditions around here in field space, and so the Calabi-Yau is going to relax to one of these minima here. So this, if you keep going in theta, this just repeats itself. So in general, you can have some initial conditions here. The inflaton is going to go zooming out somewhere and then finally relax towards one of these maps. That's the name of the model. Other important thing is the kinetic term looks kind of like this. So this phi A goes through tau and theta. And this is the form of the metric.
So you have an overall volume which is stable. And sorry, I should have mentioned you're expanding. The overall volume is very, very large. So you can write an expansion in terms of that volume. So in terms of 1 over that volume, sorry. So these are the leading order effects. There's some 1 over V cubed terms that we neglect because they're very small. And this delta V is just get some kind of outlet between manually.
So can I understand this, this I and I bar could be one or two, or?
Yeah, so this is, so we choose tau 2 and theta 2 to be the inflaton. So I and I bar, this is 2, 2. So this is K2, 2, which is the metric. So K2, 2 delta AB is going to be the metric for our effective theory.
For the but there is also another direction that has a different component, and there's a cross term.
So no, the theta and the tau, so theta 2 and tau 2 have the same, so they have the same bit.
I'm just trying to understand if you can redefine your fields to basically make that one.
I haven't figured out a way to do so. And I think you can do it if you only have one field.
Yeah.
Obviously.
But it's the question. I mean, is basically, is the curvature of your field a space? This is like a metric in the field.
Yeah, it has non-zero curvature.
It has that.
Okay. If you compute the Ricci scalar, you get it's non-zero. Yeah. A couple of properties before I move on to the actual Lagrangian is that. So
what you do, we just looked at a bunch of initial conditions. So this is that tau direction, this is that exponential direction. And so these lines here, these correspond to the minima in that valley. So if you look, so if you take an initial condition.
And you let the inflaton roll down, you can see that it always inevitably rolls down into one of these minima. And so these numbers here represent the number of defaults of each trajectory. And so, for instance, this trajectory, I'm going to come back to later, since this starts out with no component in the theta direction, so it's basically a one field inflationary trajectory.
So how do you pick the initial condition?
Friendly.
Friendly.
Yeah. We're looking for trajectories that might give interesting results. So, in general, the scalar spectral index is, so it's greater than or equal to 0.965. There are good reasons for this that I won't go into. Sometimes it can go a bit larger than 1, depending on the trajectory. There's some running of the spectral index. The tensor to scalar ratio is very, very tiny. So it depends on where you start. So if you look at this kind of region here, you get 60 foldings and above. But if you start down here, well, 1. It's obviously not going to have enough inflation.
Are those are e-foldings?
Yeah, those numbers are the number of e-foldings for each trajectory.
What is a very robust vibration of the string parameters?
What is the
mid angle? How do you choose?
So, the original paper by Baum, Christian Baum, Kaufman, looked at six or so parameter sets, and we kind of looked at those and varied them a bit. And I couldn't tell you offhand the numbers, but it seems that up to some rescaling of where the initial conditions sit, you get the same spectral behavior for these inflationary trajectories.
Because you previously said you just choose all the parameters as inflation parameters.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just wondering what is the criteria of the range of parameters you decide to choose?
The range is very large. I just chose the parameter set, one of the parameter sets from the original roulette paper, because it was there. But in general, if you change them by 200-300%, it doesn't really affect the cosmological observables. So I'm going to start talking about the non-Gaussianities approach.
Sorry, one more thing. What kind of sort of like local consistency constraints do you have? Because you know certainly like you don't want your small kilo modulus growing as large as your large kilo modulus. I mean, what restrictions do you have on your parameter space?
Right. So you want to relax towards the minimum. You want this is one issue that I'm a bit concerned about. There's a model not too long ago by Vijay Subramanian that took the inverse volume to be one of the mobile fields, one of the inflaton fields. And so he argued that that was one of the lightest fields. And so it's there could be some consistency checking to do to make sure that really the fields that you're looking at are the lightest, and that the other fields are really stabilized. And also, in terms of the initial conditions, you have to make sure that you're in some region of field space where the stochastic kicks aren't larger than what's driving you down towards this minimum. Otherwise, you get this universe that just keeps jittering and doesn't really do anything.
Maybe to re-ask the question slightly differently, the size of the hole is shrinking or it's getting bigger?
It's shrinking, yeah.
But it has to start small compared to your big one.
Yeah, it does, yeah. So it has to start fairly small. And where those initial conditions come from, well, I can't really answer. This is a model. It's string theory motivated, but it's not entirely rigorous. I'm interested in the overall behavior in terms of cosmology. So, are there any other questions about the model before I? Okay. So the separate universe approach, which is Rigopoulos, Shiller, and Van Zandt talked about in a series of three papers, and a fourth which never showed up. In 2005, they keep citing this paper with analytic results that was never actually published. So in 2005, and basically the approach is to look for, so this is looking for contributions, certain contributions to the bispectrum. So there might be other contributions to FNL. So looking for contributions to FNL that arise from the nonlinear influence of Isaac curvature modes on the adiabatic perturbations. So after horizon crossing, you have these perturbations, you have linear curvature perturbations, and you look at what the effect of the entropy modes are going to be on these perturbations at second order, first order by definition. But well, if you choose the right variable, there are none. But at second order, it turns out that you do get these kinds of interactions. So
when you're saying at first order, you don't get, but with Isaac curvature and adiabatic modes do couple. They're not really independent.
Well, okay. If you choose your variables, your perturbation variables,
it's just the fact that you don't have a single trajectory. Yeah, I don't think you can consistently separate these, basically.
Well,
you think you can?
Yeah, okay.
Maybe for some models we can, but in general I don't think you can.
Well, I'm looking at sort of the curvature perturbations, which are perturbations in the direction of rolling in field space, and the Isaac curvature perturbations.
That's right.
Which are the directions that are orthogonal.
So it's what you're doing. You're assuming that the metric perturbations induced by the Isaac curvature field perturbations are quadratic in the Isaac curvature field perturbations.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an assumption.
I see. They could be linear.
They could be linear. They could be linear.
Yes.
But some models it doesn't kick in.
So what we're going to do is we take a Gaussian source term of classical fluctuations. So we're assuming that whatever generated fluctuations created these what we can model as a classical source at horizon crossing for each wave, for each mode. And then evolve those modes, those fluctuations, through the end of inflation using the equations of motion and constraints and perturbation theory. If an observable bispectrum will survive until the end of inflation. Yes?
Is there a reason why you have to take a Gaussian source? I mean, it seems very interesting.
So this is one of the issues that may or may not affect the conclusion. So this is the assumption that they make in this approach. I'm not sure if there's a reason to do so or not to do so. It's just the Gaussian. Well, I guess the leading order effects would probably be linear. So what effects do these linear perturbations have if you evolve them through the beam? If you start out with non-Gaussian perturbations, I suppose you might even get even stronger effects.
Is there a method to compute whether or not this model can generate non-Gaussian entities even within the horizon, or is this?
So we don't say anything about what happens within the horizon, for horizon cross.
Okay.
We're just assuming what happens if you start with linear perturbations at at horizon crossing and evolve them through to the end, evolve them outside the horizon. So we'll start out with an FYW metric that we know about. And so I write down this a general action, scalar action like that. And we'll use the, so we'll work in a gauge where the time parameter is just the number of e-foldings. So this is, these are space-time slices, space-time slices of constant expansion, uniform expansion. And I'm going to use the this variable, this nonlinear gradient, as my so to describe curvature. And this is invariant under changes of time slicing to linear order.
Right, what's the delta M1 and
EM? I'm going to explain this M later. In fact, right now. So this is, I've defined this basis in field space. So the inflaton is rolling along some trajectory. You can imagine this direction would be theta, that direction would be tau, or whichever. So I'm just kind of like in GR, I've defined this basis to be, so EM A1 would be the projection of this field A along the direction of the inflaton trajectory in field space. And 2 is going to be the projection along the direction of acceleration perpendicular to the rolling in field space. So this makes the decomposition into curvature and isocurvature modes here a lot more more explicit. So I'm going to identify zeta 1 with the curvature modes, zeta 2, which was in this direction, with the entropy modes. And also I'm going to define the velocities, which is just the time derivative of these quantities as theta. I'm going to define these parameters. You don't have to memorize them. So epsilon is just the same epsilon as in regular one field, single field inflation. This eta parallel is kind of the equivalent of the eta parameter, but in the direction of rolling the field. And if you reduce to single field inflation, this reduces to the regular single field eta. This is kind of an equivalent, but in the orthogonal direction. And these, well, I guess this is kind of proportional to the mass orthogonal direction. But I'm mostly defining these not to make full roll with approximations, but just as a kind of shorthand notation. So far, we haven't made any sort of roll.
So your definition of zeta, does it have anything to do with curvature perturbations or not?
All right. So the linear zeta is the gradient of the regular zeta in the single field case. If you reduce to the single field case, that zeta I 1 would be the gradient of the normal zeta that we use.
So I is a spatial index.
I is a spatial index. Yeah. This is just a way of writing constraint equations, and from these I can point out that so theta 1, so this velocity in the one direction, velocity of the perturbation of one direction, is not independent, and so this means that I'm going to have 3 differential equations to solve to get zeta 1, zeta 2, and theta 2 to get my curvature perturbations. So I'm going to plug these into a vector, and then I can write these perturbations in this cute little form where A is some matrix that depends only on background quantities. And then I'm going to expand this into a series of, into a hierarchy of linear perturbation equations. So this is the first order equation. We assume so the first order perturbations are sourced by this Gaussian term. So this is the source at horizon crossing of these classical classical perturbations. And so each subsequent order is going to be sourced by the fluctuations of the previous order. And we're going to stop at order 2 because that's
Quick question. So the Gaussian perturbations at horizon crossing, are these, are the mode functions the traditional Hankel functions, or?
I actually can't say much. So this is the form of these Gaussian perturbations. And so it's, so we take some window function that's going to cut off the modes, the smaller modes. And this is, this quantity here is what gives you the amplitude of these fluctuations. Mm-hmm. And I am embarrassed to say that I don't know too much about this. You can compute a functional form of these. And
what is x1?
So that's it. This is x. X is the linear order perturbations that we, this is the source at horizon crossing. So this is what sources the.
So this is like this stochastic approach, is that?
So it's sort of, yeah. It's sort of, it's a bit like a stochastic approach in the sense that you have this stochastic variable that's sourcing these perturbations. But since we integrate over this, it's not, there's no actual stochastic computation behind kind of integrating over a Gaussian variable.
Well, you can, I mean, since this is a random, random variable, you cannot do the integration exactly. Isn't it a random variable? But well, this is an operator, isn't it?
Okay. Yeah, this is, right. So there are two approaches that these guys use, one of them you take to be a random variable, and the other you just, so you expand, I can't recall the exact details on how this works, so I'm not going to say too much about that. But you can rewrite these in a fun little way to get, so yeah, I can talk to you later on about the functional form of this, because it's quite important. I can't recall the exact.
I think that Hankel function is just somehow going to that x1 and various ways of.
Somehow it's a pretty simple result, and it's actually quite simple within this low level approximation. In any case, just by solving a Green's function, it's a function of so this differential equation is a function of the background quantity. So this A is just depends on these parameters that I've defined earlier. You can integrate this directly numerically to given some trajectory in your model to get these first order perturbations. And so once you have the first order quantities, you can use those to source the second order quantities. And from that, you can finally compute FNL. Just so I've been using the spatial gradient zeta. One, so just to relate to observables, we go from we look for some scalar quantity that we can observe. So we just go to from a gauge of uniform expansion time slices to a gauge of uniform density time slices. So at first order, by definition, this thing remains invariant, and at second order, you get some shift, which these parentheses denote the order of the perturbations. So I can write the power spectrum in a cute little way and the bispectrum in another cute little way. So it's just so the bispectrum is just this the sum of these functions, which. So this, if you recall, is that integral that I performed over the sources. So this gives you a k and a time-dependent FNL, which we'll define like this. And so we mostly looked at the collateral triangle limit. But it would be interesting also to look at the squeezed limit, since that seems to be much more.
I don't understand how you. So you're solving these equations in real space?
In K space.
Okay.
Right. So.
I mean, these are spatial derivatives in real space. And
right. So, so these are spatial derivatives, and you invert these kind of.
But the previous equation, they're in real space, right?
This is in K-space. This is in real space, but in K-space, this actually, this you can just very transform to give this integral. So this quantity here, this is the second order contribution. So it's a bit of a mess because this multiplies. So you have this, so this is second order in perturbations, and this integral. So this is going to multiply this. So the first order. So these would be the curvature modes, and this is the second order perturbation.
Okay, there is an answer. You should get local non-Gaussian identity of this, and that's what. That's how people get local non-Gaussian identity by super horizon evolution.
Yeah.
Is that what you're getting?
You get
the constant F and L. That's.
You get a cousin F. And you get a k-dependent
FNL.
Yeah.
So, Dinesh, I think the nonlinear interactions are derived from the scalar potential, right? So the Kähler metric, which is a Hessian matrix. So you have the k-dependence built in there directly in the nonlinear interactions.
There is no k-dependent interaction in the Kähler potential. So this separate universe approach basically assumes that you have local evolution in different places, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
So any kind of non-Gaussian you can produce is local by, I think, by construction.
Yeah.
But so I just wanted to make sure.
Let's discuss that after.
So in any case, this is just one example for a. Simple two-field inflation model. So you get this. So this is the potential I use for this simulation. And so what you typically get in these kinds of models is, so you get some kind of, so all right, so this is for initial conditions where the field starts out and say for a large value of one field and then rolls down and then there's a sharp turn in field space and finally rolls down to its minimum. So this sharp turn, at the point of the sharp turn, so this is time, and this is FNL for one particular mode, you get a spike in FNL, which is the blue line here. And then it slowly damps down to zero again, when the trajectory becomes straight. So this is the behavior for phi 1 squared, plus phi 2 squared, also for quartic potentials, and it seems to be a general behavior for flat. Potentials in a flat space where there are no finite interaction terms. So we did the same, made the same analysis for the roulette model, but in this case, you have to be careful to add a contribution from the curvature. There's some contribution from the curvature of the manifold that's already built into these background quantities. There's also a contribution from the Riemann tensor that is pretty small. But adapting the calculation, it's just a question of changing, putting in different background quantities into the numerical integration routine. So here are our results. So this is from the last couple of weeks. So for straight trajectories in field space, obviously, well, as you'd expect, the FNL is zero using this approach. Well, FNL minus 20. Numerically, it goes to zero. But so for very highly curved trajectories, you tend to get this really interesting effect. So just look at the left hand graph right now. So this is a mode that exits the horizon around this time, and so you get and so this is about when the inflaton curves in field space as well. So you get this huge spike, well, this big spike, and then a plateau off until the end of inflation, which happens here. So this is a mode that left the Hubble radius 50 folds before the end of inflation. And so this looks like a behavior this behavior occurs for most of the modes that are produced around the time of this curvature. in field space. So if you look at the k-dependent, so if you take this point, if you look at this point and say, well, and vary which modes you're looking at, you get something a bit like this. So this is, so inflation actually, so all right, so this, these are modes that left the horizon 30 e-folds before the end of inflation in this model. This is, these are modes that left, so these are large scale, like horizon scale modes that left 55 e-folds before the end of inflation. So you get this kind of, this very steep behavior. So on what long wavelengths for this particular trajectory, you get some very, very large negative values of FNL. But I should state that I'm also just looking at the simulations and running a few various initial conditions, you can also get positive values of FNL. But the general feature that seems to remain is this plateau that that appears at the as these modes leave the horizon, so this plateau in FNL.
So you can improve this part show a pink magnetic effect on the spike and the oscillation?
So this isn't k-dependence, this is time-dependence. So this is FNL, this is the Bayes spectrum during inflation. So you have this burst of non-Gaussian and then it dies down. So that it, this correlate is...
Will the evil the dependence on evil then translate to k-dependence?
No.
No, this is just for one month. That's just for, this is one mode that left the horizon 60 folds before.
One?
Yeah, this is just one mode. And the modes that occur after this
why
curvature.
Why axis is FNL?
Sorry? The
blue is the y axis.
Yeah, so the blue is FNL here. So it goes up to 2 here. And this curve is.
What is the FNL for one mode?
It probably should be the same for all modes, shouldn't it? I mean, if it's
local,
then.
Yeah. It looks about the same. Well, the modes that are that exit the horizon after this this event show absolutely no. So a couple of possible issues with the approach, in addition to the ones that were brought up here. So we were assuming that there are Gaussian fluctuations that source these perturbations at horizon crossing. Also, this study only looked at the evolution of non-Gaussianities through to the end of inflation. So we still have to deal with reheating and subsequent evolution. And it might be a bit of an issue to get large FNL, well, if this is what you're looking for, and reasonable MS at the same time. So as far as I've seen, these wonky trajectories, which generate large non-Gaussian entities, also seem to generate pretty large values of MS, or 1.5 or 2. So I'll conclude by saying that so contributions of Bayes' curvature modes to second-order adiabatic perturbations can produce reasonable, well, quite large values of FNL for large scales that persist at least until the end of inflation. This is for the roulette model, but it would be interesting to look at other Taylor inflation models or multiple field models with interesting interaction terms or curved manifolds. And so a look at the squeeze momentum triangle. So this is just for the equilateral triangle. And a look at different triangles would also be interesting, especially given the latest WMAP data.